The Three Ghosts of Microsoft Security. This is a talk given by Stephen Lamb of Microsoft UK to the BCS Edinburgh branch and IET Scotland Southeast Network on Wednesday, the 8th of October 2008. This recording is copyright BCS 2008.
The description wasn't written by me. I don't think you get many Microsofties saying, you know, our software is full of holes and blah, 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 but clearly the past of Microsoft Security, there was an awful lot we needed to change to get to where we are and where we're going. John actually wrote the abstract, and perhaps like a fool, I said, sure, that'd be fine, because I thought it was interesting. It was quite a provocative kind of title. But if you've got questions after this talk, if you think about things weeks down the line, days down the line, or you've got things that you just want to discuss and debate, please feel free to email me. My email address is my full name dot my last name, so Stephen with a PH dot lamb, L-A-M-B, at Microsoft.com. If I don't reply to you, it doesn't mean I'm ignoring you, I'm not interested. It just means I've missed it because I get lots of emails, like I'm sure many of you do. Feel free to mail me again if I've missed it. I blog actively as well, and one of the reasons I blog is because I like to get discussion with people outside Microsoft. So sometimes I'll put ideas up I'm not quite sure about and get feedback of, you know, how to do things and what frustrates people like yourselves about things that Microsoft are doing that we think are a great idea, but actually sometimes missing the reality check of what you're actually trying to do. So I'm very keen to post things I think up there and get feedback from people through comments. I also put my mobile number on there as well, which some people think I'm bonkers for doing. It hasn't been abused so far, so I'm not encouraging you to abuse it. But again, I am reasonably accessible. It also sounded a bit like a sales pitch, so you'd kind of expect that someone from a big vendor who's had a less than ideal security record is going to say, you know, it's all going to be wonderful and isn't it great? And it kind of makes me think back to the days when I started in security back in 94, where a small software firm came out of university and I thought I wanted to be a system software designer going into university. Did a year of professional programming, followed a computer science degree, and I found that actually I wanted to talk to people as well as systems, and it kind of left me in a quandary. So I joined a startup, they happened to be a security firm. I remember back in 94, I kept on being told from then forward for the next 5+ years, security's going to be really big next year, it's going to be really big. Now at some point it kind of became big, I guess, and I got hooked after the first week by chance, and that's the track that I followed to date. Now I actually changed jobs on Monday this week, so I'm no longer a security professional, I'm no longer being paid to be paranoid, but I'm still interested in security. I know it's only been 3 days, but I will continue to blog and keen to get your feedback on things as well. So that's enough about me. The purpose of the talk is to start off talking about the history. So where did Microsoft come from? What did we get wrong and why? Talk about where Microsoft is now, and then talk about where we're going. But I'm quite keen to get whatever interaction you'd like to make during the session. So I don't have 3,000 slides like you might expect a Microsoftie to have. I don't have 10-point text and 60 words a page or anything like that. You are welcome to have copies of the slides if they're useful to you. And I do blog about a lot of these topics as well. I don't get measured on how many hits I get on the blog. My new role is in PR. PR is kind of a weird beast where traditionally it's controlling a message, yet Microsoft's got 3,000 bloggers. And the stuff that the bloggers write, stuff that they think, they believe, and they post. And I remember I used to scare the life out of the PR department in my former role because I don't read my own posts before posting them. I just type them and post them, as anyone who's read my blog was probably very well aware. It's not always a good thing, but hopefully it generally is. But Microsoft do try and encourage people to just say what they think and stand by the consequences. And I've been there 6 years, so hopefully that's not such a bad thing. But I'm kind of rambling, so let me move on. So the past, by this I mean everything before Bill Gates issued the Trustworthy Computing Memo. So this is about 5 years or so. Bill typically, in his former role of Chief Software Architect at Microsoft, would issue an annual email, sometimes 2 emails a year to the whole company. If you saw anything else from Bill, you knew it was something important. The Trustworthy Computing Memo was one of those things that caused everybody to stop and think, mainly because it's from the top boss, of course, and if he says something's important, you don't have a lot of choice but to agree or maybe to find another career. There were a lot of things that were wrong in the company at the time in terms of security. So the focus was very much on features, functions, and flashing lights. You know this, I know it's history, but just to recap what happened and why. If you're a software developer at Microsoft pre trustworthy computing before this kicked off and changed how we build software. You're probably very keen to make sure that people use your stuff. Think about the year 2000, 2001, 2002. A lot of organizations wanted to get on the internet. It was kind of that thing that Microsoft were a bit slow to catch on to, but when we did, boy, we were very keen to help you do that. So we'll build a web server, build it into the OS, turn it on by default, and enable everything by default just in case you want to use those features. Clearly, that's not the secure way of doing things. That legacy was then quite difficult to change. So when you get to Server 2003, for example, we clearly learned the lesson that having everything turned on by default is not the best plan from a security point of view, but it is the best plan from an ease of use, accessibility type point of view. But there are architectural limitations, which meant that we couldn't just remove the binaries from the operating system at Server 2003. We could have things turned off by default. We could bring in things like Security Configuration Wizard, or SCW. And if you're running Windows Server 2003 or 2008, go to Microsoft.com/SCW, Security Configuration Wizard, is a really good place to go. I've blogged about this. I've done videos of how you actually use SCW in Server 2003 extensively. If you look for the word blogcast, my posts are all categorized. And if you don't remember any of this and remember banging on about something at the start, feel free to mail me and I'll put that in the mail to you or post it again. But that's a tool that's used to reduce your attack surface. So it's, what can I turn off without breaking all the applications? What are the requirements of the applications for the operating system itself? If I turn off feature X, what's going to break? SCW is predicated on the fact that the applications have got descriptions of what they need from the operating system. So those XML files written by the authors of the software, that can be any third party, but we started off with the Microsoft applications, and documenting what does it need in terms of services, features, functions, network access, types of authentication, those sorts of things. So SCW is quite an interesting piece, but what we really wanted to get to is what we brought out at Server 2008. And I will go through the, I know I said in the past, now I'm mentioning some of the future for some of you. But at Server 2008, we could make changes to the kernel and therefore actually remove the binaries completely from the system. So things that you're not using, you don't have installed on the box. Not just turned on or turned off in the case of Server 2003, but actually have the binaries on the file system at all. There's much less need to patch things you're not using. Obviously, there's a risk decision there, and we can talk about that if it's interesting. So we learned quite a lot from that early pain. We've got plenty of statistics which are on the Microsoft website if you go to Microsoft.com/security or look at many of the places that I referenced throughout the talk, which gives you statistics as what changed and why and what the impact was. But go back to what I said at the start, if you can just bear with me for a moment. You're a developer at a large software firm. You want people to use your stuff. Features, functions, flashing lights. So it's an individual thing as well as a corporate thing. There's kind of competition between the developers even today, but particularly back in those days of, John, my code's far cooler than yours because look what we can do with this. Look what people are doing with this. Look what people are talking about. John retorts, yeah, but your stuff's turned off by default. Ha ha, mine's cool, mine's on all the time. That sounds very childish, but let's face it. Well, I'm quite childish. I don't know about you. You don't need to volunteer this stuff. But there is a base thing of why did I put the effort into building something if people aren't going to use it? And there's kind of a selling job of how do I get people to turn on my stuff very much if you're a developer. Something that many people don't know is there's typically one test person allocated for every development head. Microsoft in Seattle or in Redmond specifically, there's about 30 to 35,000 Microsoft employees there. Only a third of those are developers. The rest are program management, test, and then the other pieces that go around that. Microsoft in the UK is sales support primarily. There's obviously consulting there and other functions that go with that as well. So only one in three of the people is actually building the code. But it's all very well Bill saying back in, I think it's January 2002 or thereabouts, his trustworthy computing memo, thou shalt do things securely. What did that mean to John or I as developers, assuming that we were developers of Microsoft at the time? Well, it means we've got to be really careful about how you write our stuff. Well, that's great. But what does that mean in reality? So it was well documented that we stopped development for 3 months by taking all the developers offline, and it wasn't so well documented that we took everybody else offline in terms of the tests and the program managers as well. to get them to understand, to kind of sheep dip them in what is security. But that wasn't just a one-stop thing, there's actually monthly training takes place. And we change the way that people are hired and fired and motivated based on how seriously you take this stuff. So if they don't keep up to date in what security is and how security is changing, what the threats are, what the attack vectors are, what the types of different usage are, what the risks are, if they don't do that ongoing, then doing it, what, 5+ years ago now is not really very relevant today. So it is an ongoing thing we don't make a big fuss about. Has anybody heard of blue hat? Black hat? I guess many of you. White hats, presumably some of you might class yourselves as white hats. Any black hats? Don't put your hands up if you are, I don't want to know. Blue hat started about 3 years ago. And that was where Microsoft in Seattle, or Redmond obviously, invited a bunch of white hat hackers, security researchers, and some other maybe more nefarious characters, open to interpretation, to actually come into Microsoft and spend time with our developers, to actually show them how they break stuff. Even stuff that's maybe not the latest ways of breaking things, to try and raise awareness. And it was quite an interesting experience in terms of getting those that write code that don't necessarily get security, and those that spend the whole time trying to break stuff or research how people could break stuff. Putting those in a room together was a really interesting experience, and that's continued to take place. Blue Hat's taking place again next week in Redmond. So it's something that has continued. I'm sure you've probably heard of the Black Hat briefings. I know some of you are nodding about black hats. And I'm very aware that amongst the people in the room, some of you are probably very, very technical. Some of you are very security savvy. Maybe some of you are less so. And I'm hoping this talk works reasonably for all of you. But I appreciate that's quite a wide ask. But Microsoft spoke at the Black Hat briefings and actually had their own track last year, which is kind of a weird thing. I mean, there used to be this thing about spot the Fed, and yet the Feds did the keynote. So you kind of, and then you get breakaway groups like the DEFCON group, which say, well, Black Hat's not really Black Hat anymore because it's just some corporate buy our products to fix your security problems type things. So you kind of get all these spin-off directions. But clearly a lot of things have changed over the period that I'm talking about, the last 5 or 6 years. I think we'd all agree security kind of is a big deal these days. But you hopefully agree also that many people still don't understand or don't want to understand security. I'm not very interested in lots of different things, but I'm not very interested in when I start my car, what the spark plug timing is and the gap is and all that stuff. I'm not a race mechanic. I'm not a motoring mechanic. I don't design vehicles. I just want the thing to work. And I'm a firm believer that whether we talk about the past, the present, or the future, we can't expect non-security specialists to be interested in security, yet they do still have some responsibility to do some sensible things. And I think it's for people like us, whether we work for a vendor or major organization, be it commercial, charity, or something in between, to try and help people around us understand these things. I talk a lot about new media. I'm really interested in green IT and things like that, but not just the data center. How do we change people's behavior, maybe through use of technology, to free them to work in more creative ways? When I flew here this morning, or actually flew early afternoon, I chose to get to the airport early and work in the airport rather than having the potential stress and hassle of what if I get stuck in a traffic jam, etc. I used a 3G card plugged into my laptop and I could work just as if I was in the office. Now that probably hardly sounds like news to most of you. It's like, duh, I've been using a laptop forever, working remotely, you know, doing these things. But many people in large organizations still aren't allowed to work that way because of security. It's that kind of excuse of, you can't do this because of security. Well, hold on a minute, what's the risk? Whether you're technical or not, in fact, particularly those of you that are technical or very technical, it's very easy to forget about risk and focus on the product or the technology or the feature or the kind of attack. I get people talking to me about how to break smart cards and how to do much more technical things than that, whereas actually, get into the basics of, do you lock your screen? How do you do that? Do you identify your staff? Do you do background checks on your security people and your administrators? All that kind of stuff, it's not very interesting for many people, so they focus on the deep technical stuff. But getting back to what is the risk and how do I address it? Is it something I need to care about? It's probably basic common sense to many of you, but don't get too close to things. I'll share a really brief story. When I was a student, I tended to work quite close to deadlines when I had reports to write and things like that. I remember one night I was doing a diagram remember I was doing computer science, we had hardware to do in there as well as software. And I was using Corel Draw years and years ago. And I drew this diagram, circuit diagram, and then I'd zoom in and find something wasn't quite accurate. So I'd zoom in some more and fix it, and zoom in some more and fix it. And about 4 hours passed when I was zooming in and zooming in and fixing it, and completely losing track that I was working to about 10 billion DPI. It was completely irrelevant. If I'd stopped about halfway through, even a third of the way through, you still wouldn't have noticed the difference because you'd never zoom in that far in reality. So again, something I've learned since 94 is if something seems too hard in security, you're probably looking in the wrong place. I'm sure some of you get involved in assessing security, be it code level, system level, product level. Again, it's usually the gaps between responsibility of physical security, logical security, or it's development issue, or it's an IT pro issue. For me, those are the kind of gaps where people exploit things, not the hardcore coding level or implementation level necessarily. It's not to say they won't, but just to be aware of those things. And this is perhaps more relevant for reference. But Microsoft, as part of our practical how do we improve our security stance back in 2002, we brought in this thing called the Security Development Lifecycle. There are plenty of books on this now. SDL is the abbreviation. I'm sure many of you have come across this. And part of this stemmed from, there was an audit done by, I believe, Michael Howard and Steve Lipner, but certainly many people attribute those guys as doing this. I'm pretty sure it was those guys that did it. And they're now very senior at Microsoft on the security development side. And they basically went into a major US bookstore and pulled off pretty much all the development books they could find by whomever. And then they analyzed those books back in the office to find out how many coding mistakes are in the example code. How many security vulnerabilities were in the this is how you do this particular type of thing examples. I can't remember the statistics, but as you can imagine, certainly back then, the vast majority of them were completely full of security holes. And it led them to think, well, if we're hiring people from major universities around the world, how have they been educated? When do they learn to do security? And even today, most universities don't teach security at the same time they teach basic coding. Whatever kind of level coding you're talking, whether it's, you know, what I was brought up with as development, or whether it's mashing up applications and joining things together, if you don't have some kind of thought of risk and mitigation and those sorts of things, then everything you build on top is probably going to be vulnerable. And when I learned to do development, I was self-taught before I went to university, but when I went through the formal processes, remember they talked about a graph, or they showed a graph where, imagine if you've got a mistake in your code at the time that you first think about it, compared to when it's actually deployed in a customer environment. And of course, it was exponential. Exactly the same through security. Why did Microsoft take security seriously? Well, clearly we were going to stop selling product eventually in cases where there was strong competition if we didn't get our act together and change things. But there's a strong piece of communication to go with that as well. People think about vulnerabilities in code, but there's at least as many vulnerabilities in implementation. So again, we had to put a lot of effort into trying to give prescriptive guidance of how to sorts of things. So the security development lifecycle was really how Microsoft encapsulated its basic, I want to say this word learnings, which is a horrible Microsoft Americanism that should, you know, isn't a word, and I should get slapped if I ever say it. But how did we capture up into a programmatic way how we did want people to develop code going forward? We did things like bringing competition between individuals and between teams. So you get one team to build stuff, you get experts to look at it and review it, external and internal experts. You get a team of people which we call the Microsoft Security Response Center to actually be able to stop products shipping and to review code before they actually get shipped. This was an unheard of environment. Microsoft very focused on shipping products with more features than the arch rivals, get things to market quickly and kind of go for that competitive side of things. And having a team of security geeks who can actually stop your product shipping was a huge, huge deal, and it took some time to get traction. But the MSRC are also a point of contact for people like yourselves who may find security vulnerabilities. So something they do specifically is they will own the issue. They will do the research separate from the product groups to find out, is there actually a realistic threat there? How do we get that threat fixed? Who do we need to bring together to make sure that that fix gets tracked through and actually comes to market? What's the severity of those kinds of things? People used to irresponsibly disclose Microsoft issues, typically because who do you contact? You know, Microsoft's such a big organization, where do you go? How do you know it's going to get taken seriously? How do you know it's not just going to get swept under the carpet and we'll kind of forget about that one, don't worry about it, it'll be fine. So that's where the MSRC came in. So a gentleman called Scott Culp came out with the 10 immutable laws of security. If I ever want to try and sound clever, not that there's usually a lot of point, I bring out this word immutable, or obfuscate is another good one as well. If you're not familiar with it, immutable really just means something that is always true. Search for 10 immutable laws of security. What you'll find is 10 truisms. And they're as true today as they were back then. So simple things like, if you don't have physical control over your machine at all times, it's not your machine anymore. It's all very well saying, you know, in a Vista environment, I've got BitLocker, I've got smart cards, I've got whatever you happen to mention. But if I give John access, or anybody else, I'm just picking on John because I know him, if I give him access to my box and go and get a coffee, who knows what he may or may not do to the machine. I was at a security conference it was an internal conference, partly as a result of this kind of trustworthy computing initiative, where people in the field were also sheep-dipped in the basics, even if they understood security. It was kind of, thou shalt go. But I've been doing this stuff. I mean, I get stuff wrong, I've got lots to learn always, but does it make sense to do the basic training? So my peers decided to play a trick on me. Been there for a couple of days and I was grumbling and moaning about, you know, this is wrong and that's wrong and blah, blah, blah. I went to a coffee and one of them distracted me. I didn't realize this was all the setup. Asked me about whatever, who knows. Can you explain this? He didn't, you know. I came back and found my machine was unlocked. Now, I get all kinds of things wrong, like hopefully most or all of you. Some of you are perfect, but don't put your hands up if you are. You just get beaten by everybody else. But I always lock my machine. And what they'd done was an unrealistic attack. I'm not suggesting this is a real environment. But what they'd done is we'd got identical physical machines. They'd powered my box off, physically taken out the internal disk, borrowed a screwdriver from someone about 3 rows ahead, nothing to do with our team, and actually switched the internal disk, powered it back up and logged in as them. Quite an extreme way of attacking, but I subsequently learned never leave your machine with your peers either, even if you've locked it. But it's a case of thinking what's a realistic threat. When I was a developer this year during my degree, I was writing software to control chemical plants, or making modifications to that kind of code typically. We had competitions internally, nothing to do with security, but competitions based on the person who had the most problems found with their code by peer review had to buy the beers for the team on the Friday. I'm a Yorkshireman, you probably wouldn't guess by my accent, but I don't like buying beers unnecessarily. Maybe I'm in good company here, I don't know. Let's not go there. But we used to go way too crazy on the code review because the stakes were high, obviously. So we went further than was appropriate. But actually the lessons there are exactly the same with security. There's a point at which you stop, whether you're doing code, implementation, architecture, whatever. Again, that's probably common sense. Let me just read some of the milestones here. So we had the Trustworthy Computing Memo in January 2002. We had a major security push. That's where all the product teams were told, get your act together, look through your code, do stuff. Then we had security development life cycles mandatory for all products shipping if they'd got meaningful risk. Now, of course, we had security professionals in the company 15, 20 years ago, but they were doing things like, you know, the Gina for logging in. They were doing things like encrypting file systems. They were doing security-specific tasks. But we needed to get that kind of knowledge spread throughout the company. We also did privacy requirements as well. So this officially came in at about 2006, 2007. But we talked about security by design, default, and deployment. Actually, at the same time, we also talked about privacy by design, default, and deployment. We've not made a big fuss about that, but the way that you deal with those things is exactly the same. You deal with them at, I've got this idea of something that might be a cool product or a cool feature. Let's get a team of people together to try and develop it or to decide should we take it further. Let's get a team actually building it, let's test it, and let's get it implemented. At all of those different stages, you need to think about both security and privacy. Again, this might be obvious, but this is really where it came in. We had an SDL white paper in 2005. There was a book. There's a book that's not listed on here, which is called Threat Modeling. Threat Modeling was written by somebody with an unusual name from Microsofty. They were called, or are called, Window Cider. Real Christian name. Not knocking that in case, I'm sure they won't listen to the recording, but it's a really good book, Threat Modeling. Something I've got listed later in the slides is that you'll find out more about what we're doing with this in terms of threat modeling and SDL at PDC. So whether you go to the Professional Developers Conference or just follow it online, you'll find that there'll be more resources that you'll be able to use based on the kind of things I've talked about now. So many of these exist, but there'll be more fuss and iteration made about that. I'm trying to share how people outside Microsoft can make use of this as well. We're also keen to get feedback. If there's things that you look at and think, that's rubbish, don't understand, doesn't make sense, again, feel free to feedback through me and I can feed that back through the teams or anyone else you know at Microsoft. We have got a tool mentioning threat modeling. If you think about data flow diagrams, how many of you are familiar with DFDs? Or whatever they're called these days, I say the name's probably changed. DFDs are about modeling flows of information through systems typically. So what we do with threat modeling is we look at trust boundaries and we look at what's the impact of having a threat that actually gets exploited at a particular stage in that flow of information. Where could we then go with that if we were malicious? So for example, if I was to compromise the login system to a website or a machine or whatever, probably fairly obvious what the impact of that could be. But what if I had a piece of code running in the system hidden behind the scenes that had too much privilege? Now, we've got all this wonderful security all the way through the different stages because we've all done this by the book, perhaps. But what would happen if that was exploited regardless and somehow something unforeseen that could possibly never happen actually happened? Again, that's where threat modeling comes in. So we build these trees of, well, if that happened, what would be the knock-on effect through the rest of the system? So there are tools you can use to formalize the threat models. But at a really simple level, if I leave my machine here, what's the threat? I know this is trivial, but someone could steal it. Okay, well, it's insured, or it's a risk that maybe just accept, maybe it's not worth insuring. What's the data worth in the machine? What's the reputational risk? All those kinds of things. And there's some things that you'll see if you read through any of the SDL stuff that help you bring that to life in different scenarios as well. Go to microsoft.com/SDL, you'll find a whole wealth of information about this. This is a diagram, again, this is probably more useful for reference, which talks about what specifically is in the security development lifecycle. And I'll read it because I appreciate it's perhaps a bit small for you to see there. So we establish something like a Microsoft Security Response Center. Who do you call if it all goes wrong? How do you deal with problems that were unforeseen? How do you get the developers together to make sure that you don't make the same mistakes again as have been made before? In our case, we'll typically codify ways of solving problems. So if we find, we do root cause analysis later around the chart and say, we had a vulnerability due to X. Maybe it was a coding problem, maybe it was an education problem, maybe it's working with a partner who hadn't followed the same process. Maybe we didn't have in a contract to say a third party had to use the same kind of process. Then how do we find other instances of the same kind of vulnerability? So we do those kinds of things. We also look at third-party vulnerabilities. So if Apple have a vulnerability or Linux has a vulnerability or whoever, then again, we don't just kind of get, ha-ha, that's not us this time. But we actually look at, well, what was the root cause? Because chances are it may be common throughout how people just build stuff generally. We also use third-party tools. We build tools into things like Visual Studio. So Prefix, Prefast, FXCop, they're three tools that we bought back in about 2003. And we bundled those into our standard development environment, which is Visual Studio. So again, we try and avoid repeating the same errors. We also build tools to try and find instances of those errors that we found. We then go through secure design. So my claim to fame is that I found a vulnerability in a product before it was built. That's not something I normally do, and I was just lucky to be in that environment. There's a bunch of us who were asked about a new product that they were going to build to actually help security. And we found an architectural flaw such that we, with maybe slightly malicious mindsets, a couple of us, could actually turn the thing on its head and use it to exploit the security of the system rather than to strengthen the security. So at that stage, they just scrapped it and didn't bother going any further. So the fact that they involve people even in the field, people who are fairly lowly in these kind of things, again, is a really effective way to try and find vulnerabilities. Then secure implementation. So it's all very well us building a product that we think is really secure, but clearly we need people like yourselves to try it in your environments to get feedback. But we also need to give you the guidance of, well, what's the impact of setting it up this way or that way? So things like, do you need to use IPsec to ensure encrypted communications between point A and point B? Are we assuming that? it's fine if we do as long as we document it. Ideally, maybe have a wizard or some kind of thing that raises your awareness of that. Are we using IPsec to authenticate the two parties? Again, as long as it's documented, whatever the security thing we're referring to is, if it's in your face and you're aware of it when you implement it as an IT professional, that might be fine. But we've had too many cases in the past where things like we had fixes for security problems in SQL 2000 that led to things like Slammer, where there was no install routine for the security update. We used to have security updates where there was no way to uninstall it. What if it broke the application that sat on the top? Now, these things are probably fairly obvious sat in a room like this, but we and you went through that pain to make sure that right across Microsoft, SDL made sure that those things were standard. Those were things that we didn't kind of, well, I've got this new feature, we've got an uninstall for security fix for this product, but not for that product. You know, that's not a new feature, that's just a basic kind of thing. We had common engineering criteria, which again continues throughout Microsoft, to make sure those things are standard as well. You then get verification. So that can be internal, external. We've got teams of people, Secure Windows Initiative, you don't need to know this name particularly, but it's just a name that's used internally, maybe in some of the books, which involves teams of people who don't see the source code, but their remit is to try and break stuff, and they're incentivized on breaking stuff internally. They go to all the conferences, they hang out in those not-so-sanitary environments. I don't mean them individually, but they hang out with where people hang out to find out bad stuff about software. So they've got a very different perspective from the people building stuff, but they also share their ideas and their lessons with those people too, so it's all about communication. You then get some final security review. The product groups within Microsoft are like separate companies. You think about the Office product group, it's a multi-billion pound company, effectively. Sure, it's part of Microsoft, but there's rivalry within those groups, as you may imagine. The fact that the MSRC can stop their stuff shipping kind of focuses the mind. The fact that these people come in and do code reviews when they think everything's great, the product groups think it's great, and still find problems, it means the product groups then are very focused on learning why there was vulnerabilities in there, almost from a point scoring perspective of, look, you didn't find anything this time. If you want the people around you and your businesses, I don't suggest you use your friends and family, it's maybe going too far, but people around you and your businesses to understand more about security, there's a book called Writing Secure Code that many of you may have come across. Whichever edition you get, there's a chapter, the first chapter, talks about things like the 10 immutable laws of security. It talks about why coding and security have to go together. It's not technical, it doesn't require your kind of brain power to make sense of it. It's a good introduction, or just get people to look at things like the 10 immutable laws. Really simple stuff. Then the last piece, as I say, is incident response, best practices and learning, and making sure that we learn as we go forward. And one of the core things that's kind of in the slides a little bit, and I put these together earlier, is the fact that it's not just Microsoft who've got to grips with security. Clearly, many of the platforms have very much raised the bar of security. But the challenge now, of course, is, and this kind of comes later in the slides, is that the applications that sit on the top are quite often less secure. They quite often haven't moved on. And there's enough security products out there by some infamous third parties that have got more vulnerabilities in them than the products they're trying to protect. But just basic products, there's still things like SQL injection, which is still able to take down all kinds of websites. You know, this was first documented in the late 80s. It's not a new thing. You might have an obscure perspective on how far security has actually moved, and you may think about platforms. But you may be scared if you look in the details of how poor some of the applications still are. Think about how many organizations are using code that's 5, 10, 15 years old. It doesn't matter who it's from. The chances are it's probably not very secure by today's standards. Think about how attack vectors change. Now, I carry around a laptop like many of you. I carry around memory sticks. Think about the sheer volume of data that's on those devices. Why don't we all encrypt our data? Well, there's costs of doing that. There's recovery costs. There's, oh my goodness, the dog ate the token, or I've forgotten the password, or you know, the hard disks failed. You know, there's all those complexities that go with that. But those things are much easier to do today than ever before. You don't need rocket science type knowledge to be able to encrypt a hard disk. Yeah, a lot of people still don't do that. And we've seen the press, things like government departments and major organizations have data leakage. Well, let's face it, USB sticks are really easy to lose. So why don't we encrypt them and then we don't have to worry about that? We seem to have this false kind of sense of, oh, it'll never happen to us. Think about laptops. Again, you know, I've got a shiny, flashy one here. Some of you might have noticed it's made by a rival of Microsoft. It's running Vista, I assure you. It is really running Vista. Microsoft don't make laptops, if there's any confusion here, so I don't really think it's a problem. But it does tend to start conversations. But something that's shiny, people are more likely to want to steal. So just accept that. You know, we should be able to use multiple devices, multiple phones if you choose, certainly multiple laptops and desktops. As we move towards things like cloud computing, that kind of becomes ever more the expectation. But we need to get the basics covered. This is definitely a reference slide. I just added a couple of these in thinking they might be useful. But it goes through the details of each of those stages. So for example, requirements. What are the security and privacy risks and requirements for the thing that we're going to design? Some people live life on the edge. Some people do extreme sports. They do all kinds of things that other people think is crazy. I do various sports that some people think are extreme. I personally don't think they're that extreme. Snowboarding, windsurfing, whitewater kayaking, diving, things like that. I took out insurance a few years ago for those sports. And the insurance person told me, oh, well, that's okay. You're now covered to do the luge. I think that's crazy. You're now covered to do heli skiing. And, you know, to me, it's all relative as to where you stand on these things. And the same is true with code. You might be massively trained in security, loads of experience, the best developer out there. But you may be going to way too much effort and spending too much time and trouble on the stuff that you're building based on the threat that it's actually going to encounter. This is kind of a marketing slide, really, and I'm not really trying to push you in any direction. I've included it just because it shows we've got evidence to show that it's been worth our while to improve our game. Microsoft now use security as a positive differentiator, not to go run and hide and, you know, try and persuade people that you're taking it seriously. We were taking it seriously, but it took a long time to change 10,000 plus developers and all the people around them to change how they do things, and for that code to ripple through to the environments you're using, and to get the guidance out there to get people to do things differently. But we've been able to demonstrate internally that it's worthwhile going to this level of effort, not from a PR perspective or a marketing perspective, but from it costs our company a lot of money every time there's a vulnerability. Even if you put reputation on one side and customer loyalty and all those important things, simply the time it takes to fix a vulnerability is much greater than it is to write code in the first place. So from a commercial point of view, even aside from the important things I've mentioned, it's still worth us doing it. Clearly those other pressures are probably much more significant than the coding side. Again, we've got the same sort of thing with SQL. I didn't have that many vulnerabilities in the past relative to the platform, but SQL ran a super user all the time. So a single vulnerability pretty much meant game over, potentially. It's also easy for vendors like Microsoft, but for anybody who writes code, to say, look at the progress we've made. But clearly a single vulnerability can be enough to take you down. The ones I worry about more are where people change data without you being aware of that. Those subtle tampering and changing. Again, I could have been given this talk 10 years ago. Those things are not new. But a lot of people, again, focus purely on how many vulnerabilities. The stats are down, they're trending down for, I think, all the vendors pretty much. The time to fix a vulnerability, I think, is pretty interesting. How you actually respond to those people, I think, is quite interesting too. Let's look at the present. I mentioned this already, really. I naturally went into talking about risk. But risk, for me, is the most important thing in security because it can encapsulate people, process, technology. Now, I've moved buildings having changed roles. And I know from experience, and I know no one's listening to this, and you're all friends, obviously. I've authenticated you, yeah, obviously. I found out from experience that I'm the person in the office who gets upset when I find machines that aren't locked. It's not my job. It wasn't my job. Just being in security is just, it's one of the most basic things. If you've ever been to the Microsoft campus in Reading, there's 5 buildings. The original intention was that building 3, ground floor, and part of the first floor was for the public to go to events, they could mill around, pretty easy to do. Building 2 is intended, ground floor, to be meeting rooms for customers. And then pretty much the rest of the environment is reasonably locked down physically in terms of needing passes to get places. Obviously, tailgating is trivial, but at least that was the intention of having those specific areas. Now, of course, things have changed, we've outgrown that environment, and now we typically have customer meetings all over the place, which kind of exacerbates the problem. But I'm sure you've all found how easy it is to tailgate in just about any environment. Some military environments, that's not true. Some banking environments, that's not true. You may know of other environments. But generally speaking, tailgating is pretty easy. So with that in mind, I encourage people to lock their screens because who knows who might get to the desk. People still weren't very interested to me banging on about it. And I found out that typically people would actually lock their screens if I was in the building. If I was working from home or not in the office, people tended not to do it as much. As I said, it wasn't my job, it's just something that bugged me. What I did tend to do to encourage people to actually lock their screens was point out to them what I could do with the machine if they didn't. Okay, how much do you get paid? Well, you don't want to tell me. That's all right, I've only got to go to one internal website that you're going to be automatically authenticated to having logged into the machine. Ease of use. There's an audit trail, so it shows they looked at it. Well, of course, it could have been me. Okay, how many shares have you got? Any medical problems? You can't actually get the medical details out, but there's enough things that people wouldn't want me to necessarily know that encourages them, if you just press Windows and L, it's locked, it's done, it's easy. For me, it's all very much about selling people on why it's important to do this stuff. I know this may be really trivial and common sense, but it seems to be uncommon sense in the real world. I took this sign on Salisbury Plain, took this photograph. Now, personally, I'd like all security messages to be this clear, but I know that's not realistic. I don't want to scare people about security, because many people take the view that security is too hard. I don't have time to understand it properly. It's like just about anything else that you're not focused on. I need to understand about how the tax system works so I can fill in a tax return, but I'm really not at all interested in it, except when it comes to how much I'm going to pay. If there's something that I knew that could minimize that, then maybe I'd be more interested in studying it. But to me, that's what professionals like accountants are for. I don't earn enough to warrant having my own accountant, but hopefully you get the idea. People think it's too hard, I need to know too much. Actually, you don't need to know much at all. If someone knows nothing about security, explaining the basics of risk can very much help the situation. This was actually taken on the tank ranges, and they do something called the Wessex Safari. If you've got a 4x4 and you're a member of someone like the Jeep Club or affiliated to, or just get the details on the website, you can literally just go and drive across Salisbury Plain on bank holidays and times they're not doing various things. We actually played Spot the Camouflage Jeep, Camouflage Land Rover game as well, because they were surprisingly easy to spot. And Spot the Tank was quite easy as well, which is a bit concerning, but there you go. But clearly this isn't realistic for many people. So it's about how do we bring those around us who maybe don't get security to understand just enough to make the right decisions. Just like with new media, I wrote a blog post probably 9 months ago now saying I can waste time without Facebook. Give me a window. No window, give me an internet connection. Remember when they were trying to ban the internet because you waste your time? If you measure people and what they do, they tend to be quite focused, at least at some points of the day, to get stuff done. Again, it's about changing those kind of mindsets. Development's not easy. Security's not easy. But if I know a little bit about it, then I can understand where it fits and where I need to spend time and invest. Design. Again, I've kind of been through this already in terms of the earlier slides, when we look more specifically at SDL. But fixing a security problem at design stage, as I mentioned before, is so much easier than fixing it when you built the stuff, deployed the stuff, need to recall things, put updates out there and make changes. I keep mentioning risk, and you're probably thinking, it sounds like a broken record. But again, just looking at what kind of authentication, for example, makes sense for both people from a procedural level and using the system and for software components talking to one another. If you look at the architecture of Windows XP pre-Service Pack 2, pretty much everything ran a superuser. All the services pretty much ran a superuser. Now, services are a great thing to attack if you're malicious, because if they go bump in the middle of the night, most people won't notice because they don't have a user interface. If a service isn't running, the user or the administrator may not notice for quite a period of time. If it's doing weird things, who knows? Service Pack 2 for XP brought in this ability or this aim to try and reduce what ran as privilege. So we brought in some less privileged accounts, the network user, the local user. But we still kind of had a lot of things running as privilege because we couldn't change the architecture at that stage. And my background pre-Microsoft was from Unix. I did lots and lots of different types of Unix. When I first came across a Microsoft server, being a security expert as I thought back then, I decided that this system account thing What's that about? Why did I have that and administrator? Administrators like root, so system, don't need that. So I foolishly removed access from system for everything and quickly learned how to rebuild a Microsoft server. Completely trashed it. So when we got to Windows Vista, we brought in some fundamental changes to the architecture. Things that I talk about quite a lot and I've written about quite a lot, but we don't really make a big fuss about. So we did simple things like saying, if we've got a service that's running as privileged, based on what we've carried over from XP and code reviewed and been through, then let's see which parts of it actually need to be privileged. And we'll break the service up such that only the parts absolutely need privilege have privilege. And then we'll build other services with less privilege that will then be called or talk to that service. We also, this sounds like real common sense stuff, but it wasn't in the platform until Vista. We brought in the ability to automatically authenticate services to one another. So we gave them a security identifier, so you can have access control lists and full authentication of communication between services. We brought in the ability for services to have a list of which, based on the access controls, which services should this service talk to. If you're not on the list, you're not coming in. Again, basic security stuff. So how do we reduce the risk? Other things like saying we had this as a bit of a mouthful, but mandatory integrity control. This is the ability we talked about, we call it protected mode in IE 7 and onwards. This is the idea that you can have a process, in our case IE, but it could be any process, running with less privilege than the guest user. The premise being, if and when that process is compromised by a configuration or a coding vulnerability, or a change of use which makes something vulnerable, then the worst possible impact of that is only of things of that level of privilege. So in IE, you can only compromise, assuming you compromise iExploit.exe, you can only compromise things that are in the temporary internet users area, also temporary internet files area, because that's the only area that's the same low level of privilege. So it doesn't mean there'll never be a vulnerability, but it means what's the impact, if you look through the threat model, of what could be done as a result of that. We brought in things like user account control. Now, some people find this annoying, but the intention of it is for people who are not administering the system, people who are using it day to day, to be made aware if something attempts to use privilege. If the user's got the ability to make system changes, then of course they get the dialog box that says, do you want to accept this or not? If they don't have privilege, then it gives them a dialog saying, can you enter the credentials of somebody who does? Again, that's not groundbreaking stuff. And a lot of people kind of assumed that that was for everybody. So, you log in as an administrative level user, you're trying to build the box, and you keep getting this dialog box coming up. And that's not the intent. If you log in as the built-in administrator, you don't get the dialog. If you go into the local security policy or the group policy options for the machine, if it's in a domain, then you can override those settings. We started off with the worst default. The worst default was you didn't have this, just accept that the operation was going to take place. We got the administrator to enter the credentials every time as well. Now, apart from that being annoying, it led to the wrong behavior because we don't want people entering credentials willy-nilly from anything that asks for it. So that was from customer feedback that we changed that. I tend to start a shell. So I'll start a command shell, got a shortcut on the machine, run that as privilege, or run MMC as privilege. And then you don't get prompted all the time. But when I'm doing day-to-day stuff, I want to know if something that I've accidentally triggered that may be malicious is trying to reconfigure my machine. So again, it's about selling in terms of where does UAC fit, what's it for? I mentioned vulnerabilities. We've got there's a threat report, there's a new one due out at PDC, which talks about what is the Microsoft Security Response Center seeing in the way of threats in the environment. Microsoft's got a really interesting view on security because we get all the crash reports, unless people say don't send the crash report through, and they are anonymous. But we get to see what kind of things are breaking typically. Those reports enabled us to see with Windows XP that the vast majority of crashes that we were seeing, I think it's more than 60% of crashes, came down to less than 10 vendors' applications. So actually less than 10 vendors' drivers. Knowing who those vendors were, because their code was signed, if it was signed, enabled us to then go back and help them to fix those problems, which then made us look better. It stopped us looking so bad, but it also helped people get more from the systems. Windows Vista, if you're on 64-bit or any platform beyond there, so Server 2008 and going forward, we force that the code is signed if it's a driver. by doing that, it means that we actually know for sure. Well, I say for sure, you never know for sure, but you've got much more confidence who wrote the code. Again, help in that process. We've got the there's a malicious software removal tool, which is an optional install when you do Windows Update. Again, some of you may have come across that. We get stats back every time that runs. And this is the kind of thing that goes into the report, the threat report. Something I find quite interesting from those reports, and this is all in the public domain, is that it's all very well saying, okay, John's machine automatically ran the malicious software removal tool, and it removed these particular problems, and then all was good. But what happened next time Windows Update ran, and this optionally ran as well? Oh, look, John's got the things back again. Well, how's that working? So we've got interesting stats that show actually many antivirus products don't necessarily help you in the way you may think. They're not a bad thing to have. But quite often, machines are constantly getting reinfected, often with the same kinds of things. So we use that for both reporting, for sharing the information, and also looking at root causes as well. So we get a lot of information that we share, which helps us understand these things better. This isn't a stat I put in here, but it's suggesting more than 60% of vulnerabilities in web applications. I think web applications certainly are vulnerable, but I think legacy applications are at least as much of an issue. The code I was maintaining when I was a software developer, I'd spent 80% of my time working out what the existing code did. There was no documentation, the code was 20 years old, and it was business critical. And it was controlling the production of sulfuric acid and unimportant things like that. You know, things go bang, who's going to notice? But that's not as uncommon as some of you may think. Some of you nodded and kind of agreed. But it's code that was written before security was a big issue. Okay, well, why wasn't security an issue? If my machine's not connected to another network and I don't introduce removable media and I don't let anybody else use the machine, that's an awful lot of things, I maybe don't need to worry about security. If we go back 10 years ago, a lot of people weren't connected to multiple networks. Think about what I mentioned earlier. I used a 3G card earlier in the airport. I could have used a wireless network. I just didn't want to pay for it, so I got the 3G card instead. I work from home. I've worked from the Microsoft office in Edinburgh this afternoon. We're becoming very transient with our use of networks. We're also tending to become very transient with our use of machines as well. I personally won't use somebody else's machine for something that I think is sensitive, because it could have any kind of compromise on there that the user may not be aware of. Could be in kernel mode. Going forward, it could be in the hypervisor. It could be in user mode and be very effective. I won't enter my credit card details into anybody else's machine just because I'm kind of paranoid. I don't have a big reason to do that realistically, because the threat to me is pretty low. The bank will probably, actually maybe they won't anymore, they're a bit skint at the moment. But look at the banking side for a moment. If I had a dodgy transaction go through, how did the bank prove that my machine was insecure? They can't audit my machine legally, certainly in the UK. So there's some interesting precedents. They tend to pay out because it's typically what happens, but maybe that will change at some point in time. But you also get interesting things as well. So I think the banks had the ability before to say no, but tended to pay up for business reasons, because it kind of took one of them to say no and kind of change those things. But you also get things like, I had dodgy transactions go through my credit card. It got cloned somewhere from the magnetic stripe. Got tracked very quickly. The bank were really good about it. But they then sent me a form. I thought the form was quite funny. I nearly blogged about it, but I managed to hold off. And the form asked me, do you use the internet? Yeah. Do you use the internet for shopping? Mm-hmm. What's your IP address? Why do you want to know that? It's an RFC 1918 address. It's non-routable like most other people's. It goes to my access point. Do you want my external or my Mac? Which computer do you want it for? Or am I using my phone? It was a nonsense question, and it was one line. Okay, and then the next one, or maybe the other way around. What's your internet service provider? Okay, which one do you want? Again, one line. I've got four. I've got work. I'd got a 3G card that I was using currently. I'd got one that was about to be retired. I had a couple of weeks crossover between them. I'd got broadband at home. Okay, which one do you want? I could see why they sent me the form, but it was completely out of date and meaningless. Again, there's still a lot of things that need to change. This slide really just reiterates what I was saying before about where people tend to focus their efforts on security. The first one says design. What percentage of enterprises do security testing at design stage? Suggests zero. This is a Gartner source from 2007. 10% implementation, 20% at verification, and 70% when it's out there in the world and live. My experience suggests that's perhaps not far short of the mark. Depends entirely on your organization. If you're military or any of those other particularly sensitive areas, maybe you do things differently. They have their own problems. Some things the military get really, really well and really right, but then there's other kind of challenges there too. CESG had an interesting challenge 4 or 5 years ago. They talked about this at a conference, at least. And they talked about the fact that they would go through a ratings process, kind of like Common Criteria, but on hardware. And they'd say, basically, we've got a big delay from a device being available to it being able to be used for high security and, you know, different classifications. And the challenge that they faced was interesting because it was a social challenge. So let me get this right. You wanted me to use a 5-year-old mobile phone. Did we have color screens 5 years ago? We probably did, just about. But users are pushing back against lack of functionality. And now we make a fuss at Microsoft about Windows Mobile 6.1. Through software, you can pretty much guarantee that the camera doesn't work in the device if you choose to turn it off centrally for that kind of environment. We've kind of almost come full circle. The security requirements are so tight that they're unattainable because users expected more. Think about users being in control. In many organizations, users have got more infrastructure capabilities at home than they do in the office. Why can't I send an instant message to somebody who works in my organization somewhere else in the world? Well, obviously, there's reasons of auditing and control. Maybe there's Chinese walls between different parts of the organization, maybe an investment bank and a commercial bank and those kinds of things. There's good reasons why it just wasn't trivial. But from a non-technical end-user point of view, it makes no sense. I've asked people from all kinds of organizations, how do you find out the phone number or the email address of somebody that you know the name of who works for your company, but you don't know anything else about them? Or, I need to speak to somebody in finance in Hong Kong at Microsoft. How do I do that? People have got things like GALS, like you get with Active Directory. They've got equivalent in Lotus Notes and all kinds of other platforms. But often that information is not populated. Things are just so hard. How do you book a day's leave in your organization? You have to go to the office and fill in a form to send to somebody who signs it and fills in a form. I know that's the world that many people live in. Maybe you do. Technology has alleviated those things for a very long time, potentially. So we need to kind of bridge that gap between the infrastructure end users expect ever more so as time goes on, and mitigating the threats and the risks associated with that. Let me just skip through a few more slides. So I've mentioned people, process, and technology. But we talk about basic, standard, advanced, and dynamic in terms of, we call this infrastructure optimization. You may or may not have come across this approach. It's really saying, are you firefighting? Are you dealing with problems all the time? Or are you doing proactive things, avoiding problems? Maybe not avoiding problems, but you kind of take that the wrong way. And sorry, I'm rambling a bit. I don't think you should avoid security risks. I think you should measure them, mitigate the ones you're not comfortable with, and document the ones you're going to accept. That's why I kind of questioned about the avoiding. But ideally, we want to be in a situation where we don't get, this has gone wrong, this has gone wrong, but we get to the, here's what we're doing to avoid problems in the future by architecting better solutions, putting better technology out there, reducing costs. Think about IT, it's about getting the right information to the right people at the right time. I suppose that's secure IT, because I said about the right people. But we need to get these things sorted out. So basically, if we look at the definitions, security is reactive, customer risk is undefined. We don't know. Standardized, security is proactive, customer risk is understood, not necessarily mitigated. Maybe we can't make any changes, maybe we have no budget, no ability to change things. Maybe we don't have the remit of people senior enough to make changes. Advanced, security is integrated, customer risk is controlled. In the environment I work in, I'm a member of multiple different groups within Active Directory worldwide. Those groups mean that I can get access to resources, be they websites, applications, or data. And it's seamless. I log in, that stuff works. Some of the more secure levels, I may have to put a smart card in, I may have to do some extra steps. But it's automatic. I don't, the security thing is kind of easy from an end user perspective. I used to talk about wireless security and ask in organizations and in rooms like this, how many of you are doing wireless, how many are not? And I used to use it as a way to assess the security culture of the organization. Because typically people would say 5 or 6 years ago, we're not doing wireless, it's not secure. Okay, well, wireless is going to happen anyway, as it probably did. It was much better to say, here's how we're going to do wireless, here's a prescriptive route, because most people didn't want to engineer their own solutions. Then dynamic is security specialized, customer risk is minimized. So clearly that's where we want to get to. We don't want too many surprises. We want to just deal with exceptions, and exceptions to be infrequent. But we need to make things easy for the user. The way wireless is certainly at Microsoft and probably for many of you is I go to the office in the morning, if I'm going to the office, open my machine, log on once, and then I roam from building to building. The thing just deals with it, like starting the car. It's like, I don't care how it works. It's actually authenticated me to the machine. The machine's authenticated to the domain. The keys have been exchanged, and all kinds of things happen behind the scenes. As a user, I don't want to have to establish VPNs and authenticate differently and muck about. And that's probably matured for many of you now. You probably don't have that kind of hassle. I don't know. Maybe there's exceptions. But security generally should be like that. What's the risk? Well, the risk is I've got sensitive data on my machine. Somebody unauthorized may gain access. Okay. What's the impact on the organization? What is unauthorized? What is a valid form of authentication? Those are kind of things that we get to it standardized. By the time we get to dynamic, we know that we've got tools out there looking for unusual activity. We know that our users have got some degree of training, even if they're not at all technical, not at all security-oriented, even if they know someone malicious can see how much you get paid by looking at your machine if you don't lock it. That might actually be enough to actually do quite a big mitigation of threat. Depends on the environment. Your data is encrypted. In brackets, the help desk can recover the data if it gets eaten and there's a problem. Close brackets. So you don't need to worry so much if you lose your device, but it's still pretty embarrassing. It's still got a financial cost in terms of replacing the device. Of course, encryption isn't everything. Encrypting adds complexity. It therefore can add cost. So it's not a free kind of thing. In a lab environment, sure, encrypt everything, authenticate everything, analyze every line of code, don't have any code from third parties. You don't have the ability to contract to say, you'll do it this way. But in reality, of course, we have mergers and acquisitions and not enough time, not enough staff, too many systems. And it's always that kind of compromise we have to reach. Again, another summary of SDL. We look at our vision. We model the environment. We identify the threats. We mitigate the ones that we're not comfortable with. We don't mitigate all the threats because that's too expensive and takes too long. Now, in a high security environment, you might not be happy with any of the threats, and therefore you mitigate all of them. In a lab environment, you might say, you know what, we'll use that standard test password, we're only showing people the software, and therefore you maybe mitigate none of them. That's fine as long as you understand that. You then validate that, and then you keep going around that loop. Just before I go forward, SDL, security development lifecycle, pretty much applies almost exactly the same for infrastructure. It doesn't matter if I'm looking at lines of code or implementation of a system, whether I'm editing a configuration file or a source code, or I'm changing which cables into which network port. It doesn't matter where I look at those things. I can take the same kind of approach. So regardless of your role, these things could be relevant. We then talk about stride and dread. Now, I haven't enumerated dread in this. This is really for reference. But stride is spoofing, tampering, repudiation, information disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege. EOP, elevation of privilege. These are, what are the kind of things that the attacker could do? And dread is, what is the impact that they could do to the environment having been through these things? Damage, reputation, I can't remember what they all are now. It's a while since I've been through it, but it's all in the books. Writing secure code goes through it in detail. Threat model mentions it in detail. You can read it all on the Microsoft website as well. Go to microsoft.com/SDL. You don't have to buy the books. It's just convenient offline. And we talk about each of the entities. If you think back to our data flow diagram approach of this threat modeling. So we're looking at entities. Are they internal or external? Have we got control over those entities? We look at the processes. What are we doing with that data? And then we think, well, what's the worst thing that could be done with that data, and do we care about that? We look at stores of data. Something that's not listed and I haven't mentioned is also things like availability of data. I talked to a large organization not so long ago who said that they've migrated everything to an Amazon environment. Nothing wrong with Amazon as a solution provider. But they calculated that having pushed everything into the cloud, terabytes and terabytes of data and processing, when they came to do their what if it all goes horribly wrong type assessment, they realized it was going to take so long to pull the data back and then host it somewhere else or continue to host it internally, they'd be out of business. So do they keep the data locally and put it in the cloud? And there's all these kind of complexities. I wrote a talk for InfoSec back in April, and it was titled something like Virtualization and Security. And what it was trying to get to was, does virtualization make security better or worse? And slide 2 said, kind of depends. You know, virtualization is clearly very popular at the moment in all its different forms, not just the data center, but all kinds of different forms. Presentation virtualization, running virtual machines on the client machine and managing them centrally and seamlessly interacting between the two, all kinds of things that are possible. But virtualization is bad from my perspective because it adds complexity. It changes the game. And it's good because you get separation, potentially more control, modularity. Hence, it's good and it's bad. And if you're interested in the topic, there was a talk at TechEd by Steve Riley back in June. That was the US TechEd. The slides you should find online already. The slides from InfoSec are definitely online, and they go through some detail in the notes. Or feel free to ping me a mail and we can chat about it. The fact it's different is the biggest threat to me. You also get, of course, threats in the hypervisor, the piece that sits underneath the kernel, underneath the machine. It's a piece of code that could be targeted. There's lots of stuff we do at Microsoft to try and minimize that, make it as small as possible. And I'm maybe kind of going off topic slightly. But the fact it's different brings in new threats. I've already mentioned the Microsoft Security Response Center. I put this slide here just to remind myself because I thought I might forget to mention it. If you go to Microsoft.com/MSRC, you'll see a good description of what it's about. And it's something that if you find vulnerabilities, it's a place you can report things to as well. So the future, let me just go back this slightly. I was asked to do a talk for the Information Security Forum a few months back, talking about security and talking about futures. And I also did one for another organization as well. And I realized quite quickly that the future for many of the people there was actually the past for me, because it was deploying Vista or Server 2008, when people, for cost reasons of changes and deployment and all those things, were still running an XP or 2000. One organization has still got NT351 in production. You know, I joked about NT4 and said, I've got 351, it's okay. There's business reasons why changing can be expensive. And I've been quite frightened how much many organizations spend on deploying desktops. You know, ridiculous amounts of money. And there's lots of automation that's out there to try and minimize that. But even if you use the most automated method, it's clearly not free to make a change, even without licensing changes. So understand that there's mixes of environments. But let me mention a few things that are future, some of which are future for you, some of which are future full stop, because I appreciate there's a mix of people here. Now, I didn't ask for sound, but there's a local lad who said something that I think is very relevant. Now, if we're all really quiet and I'll shut up, see if you can hear it, but if you can't, then we'll manage.
We want this and that. We demand a share in that and most of that, some of this, less of that, and more of this, plenty of this. Nothing. We want it now.
Now, if I had any prizes to give away, I'd ask you how many F words did I have to take out of that 11-second clip? That many. And I appreciate he's not from Edinburgh, he's from the other side of the country, but hopefully that's not a problem. But that's what a lot of users want. They don't want this whole, you'll use that machine, sat there, working those hours, doing the job the way it's always been done. Kind of coming back to what I was saying before with the green stuff. The way most organizations can have a lower carbon footprint is by letting people use technology to free them to work the way they want, when they want. But that requires cultural change such that people measure by what they do, not how they do it. So future is security keeping step with changes in requirements. I mentioned PDC, obviously it's future, it's happening in a couple of weeks' time. But it's definitely worth watching the blogs. There's a Twitter feed for it as well. I blogged about that yesterday. PDC 2008 is the Twitter feed. And you'll find lots of information about things I've talked about and other things that might be relevant. And you don't have to pay to follow that. I believe in effective security. If you want something to kind of talk to people about in your business who maybe don't get security, think about it being effective. Again, that's all about doing the minimum number of things to have the biggest impact. You read these security guides, or you may have read them, that say, turn on this, turn on this, turn on this, turn on this, buy all these products, do all this stuff, do all this stuff. Most of it doesn't have much impact in the real environment. I've told this story many times, but I worked as a consultant in a data center for a while. They had five different levels of firewall, five different vendors, all in serial. They didn't understand how any of them worked. It's completely pointless. In a lab environment, sure, having multiple, if there's a vulnerability in one, it may not be exhibited in the others, and that's all good. It'd be much better having one firewall and paying the best person who understands that firewall to look after their firewall. This is a multi-million, so it was a million user environment, and it was enormous big infrastructure, it was parallels of everything, failover everywhere, lots and lots of security. It was a nightmare to administer, it was not effective. Simplicity for me is the best thing in security. Figure out the things that really matter and absolutely do those things. Think about your boundaries. This isn't meant to be a Linux joke, someone pointed out to me afterwards. Where is the boundary for your network? Who gives a stuff about networks? Information derived from data is far more relevant. I use multiple devices. I use mesh, so cloud services. You might use MobileMe or, I don't know, whatever you might want to use. Over time, we'll get much more used to having information being available on multiple devices by whatever means. You've probably come across this deperimeterization concept that the Jericho Forum started championing 3 or 4 years ago, maybe more. And this, you can't hide behind walls because we've got all these networks connecting lots of things. But still many security architectures and software and training still focus around this is mine and I'll look after this and that's yours and I won't trust that. If you're in a large corporate network like the one I work on at Microsoft, why would you want to trust that other people's machines are secure? Well, they're centrally managed and there's all kinds of things to mitigate risk, but actually I still don't want to trust that the other 89,000 people's machines are configured correctly, thank you very much. You know, things like IPsec help with that. Microsoft segment our network into 8 different groupings, but think of it as 3 for simplicity. Support, development, everything else. Support machines don't need to talk to my machine. You could argue maybe if I phoned tech support and wanted remote control for solving a problem, there'd be an exception. But generally speaking, what the support professionals at Microsoft are doing is replicating customer problems. They might be running down-level versions of platforms, not being patched to replicate the customer environment. It's all kind of reasons why they've got a different threat profile. Same with development machines. They're running code that's not even finished. Even though it's been through security development lifecycle as it's been built and designed, there still could be reasons why it's not been locked down as far as it's going to be when it goes into production. So having boundaries is really effective. IPsec has been around forever. I would be surprised if any machine you're running, even your NetPCs if you've got those, can probably do IPsec. But most people, when they look at IPsec, they might go to microsoft.com/IPsec and see lots of guidance of how you implement it. But the problem is people get carried away, so they'll then try and become an expert in IPsec or bring in someone who is. And they'll start encrypting everything everywhere and authenticating everything everywhere. As soon as you start encrypting, there's a cost associated. You can't inspect the data with most security tools. You've got more help desk calls potentially. You've got more complexity. You're generally much better off using a risk-based approach, encrypting the stuff that's absolutely sensitive, authenticating as many things as you can. If machines are members of a domain, you can do that automatically. You can deploy that through group policy. If you get your machine onto the same network as mine, you compromise the network somehow, my box still won't talk to your box. Unless it's a member of the same domain in the same IPsec group, unless there's an exception, it just won't talk, it'll just ignore all the traffic. That's a really simple premise that cuts out lots of different attacks. Okay, last few slides for you. Is that a healthy place to use the internet? Do you reckon they're going to have lots of good security on there? You want to do your online banking? Well, you've got SSL, so it's secure, isn't it? Can I ask at conferences, I used to speak at quite a lot of conferences, how many people are allowed to access corporate email from an unmanaged machine? Oh, I've got a blinking token, sorry, a time synchronous token, or maybe you've got access to use a smart card even, which is unlikely, but maybe you do. Are you going to use corporate data? Are you going to access sensitive stuff from an unmanaged machine? Typically 60-70% of the hands would go up and say, yeah. Think about smart cards. That seems like a wonderful idea, and they can be quite good. But people have this idea of, I'll digitally sign something. You don't digitally sign something. You instruct the software to do it, which talks to the hardware, which talks to the smart card and the reader and does that for you. If anything between the device, the firmware on the device, and everything between there all the way up the stack to you is compromised, waste of time. Classic type of attack with a smart card. So you get the user to do a valid transaction on the smart card. So you wait for that to happen just through normal means. And if the machine's already compromised, you then piggyback and say, oh yeah, and while you're at it, seeing as you've already unlocked the smart card, can you just do this as well? And it's trivial kind of stuff. Does anybody know why Rindal won the algorithm challenge for AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, replacing DES? Well, the reason was that Rindal does spoof transactions. So if you're looking at the heat signature of the smart card, prior to Rindal, the other algorithms typically were vulnerable because you could see which operations were being performed, and from that you could potentially, if you're really lucky or very, very clever, you could work out what the transaction was actually going to be, and then potentially you could derive what the key was. There's a lot of ifs, but potentially. Rindal does dummy operations such that if you look at the heat signatures, you can't tell what's really going on. Probably didn't need to know that, and I don't quite know why I told you, but there you go. That looks like a much nicer place to use the internet. Comfy chairs, nice lighting. It's blue, which is going to lure me in there because I like blue colors. Clearly, while it looks like a safer environment, there's no reason to believe it is. Okay, last one. Is that healthy? Well, you're probably assuming I'm bound to say yes. But actually, you've got some dude sat in a street corner with an expensive-looking laptop. He's willing to get mugged. Not really the point of the slide, but how do we know whether that machine complies with the core parts of corporate policy? If we're looking at future for many of you, this might be present for some of you. Future, I want to know, as an IT person in an organization, whether that's the person I think it is, and more importantly, or as importantly, does that machine comply with corporate policy? But I don't want to inconvenience the user and get them to spend 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 2 minutes even, not being able to connect. I want to assess those things quickly and easily. That's where network access protection, which is a feature of Windows Vista and Server 2008, comes in to be able to assess that part of the system. But there's 80 partners who've extended that, such that it looks at 80 different applications in addition to the platform. So it's not just about saying, is this configuration exactly how the machine is? What we do is simple things like saying, with the built-in features in the platform, is a firewall turned on? Don't care which one. Any firewall that's integrated with the security center on the client, if it's turned on, then that tick will be effectively checked. And everything's signed and encrypted, the communications between the bits of infrastructure. If the firewall vendor has written a system health agent, an SHA, that's installed on the client machine, then we can go much further than that. So we can look at the specific configuration of that application. So any security type application would benefit potentially from integrating into this approach. It's complex what happens behind the scenes in terms of a request goes in and the traffic's not allowed to route until the policy server's been checked to find out what the current policy is for this user based on which organization unit they're in potentially. And you know, there's stuff that happens behind the scenes. This is all built into Windows, Vista and Server 2008. Really, really powerful technology. There's also remediation built in as well. So what do we do if the machine isn't compliant? Is it not compliant because it doesn't understand this functionality because it's pre-Vista? Maybe it's an Apple Mac, maybe it's a Linux machine, maybe it's XP. we built it into XP Service Pack 3, but let's say it's before that. We can have a policy to say the machine doesn't understand any of this stuff. What do we do in that case? We can give it access to a certain subset of the environment, so you can bring it in over time. We can do the same as we do with IPsec, where most people dive into IPsec and encrypt everything, authenticate everything, and you know, go live with it. But the prescribed approach that we recommend if you go to microsoft.com/IPsec is actually to say, let's start in reporting mode. Don't enforce anything, but let's get reports back to see what would happen if we enforce this. And the approach at Microsoft was pre-implementing IPsec, so again 3 or 4 years ago, many of our users hadn't joined domains because there wasn't really enough benefit for them in doing so. And our users typically have admin rights and build their own stuff and all those nightmare-type scenarios potentially for security. By forcing IPsec on people over time, they couldn't get access to things they wanted. This was a spin-off benefit. It wasn't the intention. We found our domain joining percentage went up dramatically. Now, our infrastructure is very weird in that we do allow people to be admins. Maybe that's not so weird, actually, but the level of building your own stuff and changing things and trying things is pretty unusual. Now, of course, if you can stop a user having admin rights, they're much less likely to break their own machines. Yeah, we don't tell them that. We say, you can't have admin rights because you can't. Most users don't want their machines to break. Some don't want to tinker, and maybe you tinker, and that's fine. You kind of accept if you tinker and break it, you fix it. Microsoft, you have a choice. You either opt in, have it managed by somebody else, don't have admin rights, or as most people do, because we all think we're technical, some are, some aren't, then we say, I'll build it myself. But we typically build them across the network now. So we use Windows Deployment Services, which is a free optional install for Windows Server 2008. It's an optional install for XP Server 2003. Just download the Windows Automated Installation Kit, WAIK. Build it across the network, nice and easy. But there's still the security potential risks that go with that. So we make sure they're managed properly. Network access protection is cool because it's not just for remote access, but also for wired and wireless access. So if you're coming in through DHCP, if you're coming in through routing mode access, if you're coming in through wireless, if you're coming in through 802.1x, so port-based authentication, if you're coming in through something like a Cisco network admission control device, that all integrates nicely as well. There's loads and loads of good stuff in there. The thing that drives me crazy is NAP's built in. It's free. We don't charge extra for it. There's no extra license for it. There's no extra CAL for it. You do need a client access license to use NAP, but you'd need the same license to be a domain member. So if you're a domain member, there's no additional charge. I say it drives me crazy because I'm a shareholder. But as far as you're concerned, it's something, if you spend the time understanding the complexity, then you can get benefit without much expense. Of course, that's the challenge. Of course, you're changing your infrastructure. It's not a free thing to do. But from a cost to Microsoft or a charge from Microsoft, it's a free thing to do, assuming you've got domain membership. If you want to know much more about NAP, go to microsoft.com/NAP. I've blogged extensively about NAP. I've got demos on my website. There's lots of webcasts you can see about it, all kinds of things. If you write code and want to know how do you integrate NAP into your code, I've written about that on the blog. I've linked to articles that go into lots of detail, but they're all on microsoft.com/NAP. There's reference slides you can have on here if it's interesting. I've already put these in the public domain, the latter ones that I've got on the screen now. But I won't just stand here and yammer on because we'll be here way past closing time, and I'm sure some of you want to drink. I'm not buying, by the way. I'm a Yorkshireman, remember. I'm happy to take questions. I've no idea what the time is. If you need to go or want to go, just had enough, please feel free. I'm sure we're having a proper closing anyway. But that's all I've got to say, but I'm happy to take questions. I'm happy to interact offline if you'd like to as well. Oslo is a code name for technology that will be talked much more about soon in the public domain. Some of it's in the public domain, but much more. Certainly by the end of TechEd, a lot of the things that I can't talk about will be in the public domain. But what we look at with any technology that we're thinking about building or have built is, what's the threat model? Now, we don't threat model the whole system, but we threat model the bits that we perceive to be vulnerable or potentially likely to get abused. We threat model a lot of it, but you go to different levels of detail, just like with DFDs. You know, high-level threat model, as I mentioned, is my box, you lot, whatever I might be doing next. But you can go into lots and lots of detail, and you drill in on those things that are important. But the answer to your question is, Yes, we do look at that stuff. And we work with third parties just in case we've got it wrong. You can never have too many experienced eyes looking at security. Having lots of eyes looking at security doesn't necessarily get you any benefit, though. Michael Howard gave an analogy. He said, this many eyes idea of security being a good thing is kind of nonsense, because if you go down to your local airport, if we all go and have a look at 747, assuming none of us are flight engineers or trained for this kind of thing, we can go around and try and kick the tires maybe and see how many wings it's got and, you know, look at the basics. Can you move the flaps around a bit? That all looks good. But unless you actually know what you're looking for, then the benefit's minimal. But absolutely, as many security trained eyes as possible looking at commercial, open source, doesn't matter, is a good thing. I think that's the biggest challenge. That's kind of like somebody saying, I don't know, or kind of depends. But it is really kind of depends. The answer to the question I would say is, stop the user having admin rights in the first place, therefore they can't just press OK. That's not necessarily trivial. How do you deal with applications that won't run without privilege, for example? Why do applications need privilege? Why do I need privilege to install an application? Well, the answer is I need privilege to install an application if it's going to change other users on the system. If it's only going to change my experience and potentially my security, it's not system-wide, I shouldn't need privilege. And yet we're all in the mentality of I'm installing something, I need privilege. So there's a lot of things, to answer that question technically, there's a lot of things you have to change. But social engineering, and it's been talked about for years as a big threat, I'd say it's the biggest threat. I compromised a speaker lounge once to prove a point. I kind of think, how or why would you do that? And I'm kind of aware this is being recorded. But what I did was I went to an internal conference. There's 5,000 Microsofties there. And I thought about it in advance. Then I went storming into the speaker lounge and said, I'm all stressed and pretend to be as stressed as I could possibly be. Working on the premise that the people, and don't do this at home or anywhere, especially not a Microsoft conference. And it's not a claim to fame, it's just trying to illustrate a point. The people behind the desk are focused on the event being successful. Events successful based on speaker scores, or the audience scoring the speakers based on what the sessions are like, typically. So if the speaker's crap, I don't mean to offend anybody by my diverse use of language, then the punters, the customers, probably won't be very happy, even if they're internal. So the people behind the desk where everyone needs to perform, whatever we can do within reason to get people to perform, we'll do. Someone comes in stressed, I've been told I've got to do this talk, 2 o'clock this afternoon, my boss has dropped me in it, I don't want to do it, someone's sick, whatever the story, they're likely to forget things like, well, hold on a minute, are you really who you claim to be? Because they don't really care. If you're prepared to go and stand on stage, well, you know, good luck to you kind of thing. Benefits you get in hacking a speaker room is you get somewhere to sit, where you can put your stuff, you get food when you want, there's not really any other perks than that, but if you're one of 5,000 people who you can't put anything down anywhere apart from in a closet somewhere, those are quite important benefits, potentially. Just illustrates a point. If you try and get people to do things which are slightly outside what they'd normally do, you can probably encourage them to do it if you're confident enough. If it's way outside, then you can't. There's something called the cool curve. Dr. Toby Moores, has written about this thing called the cool curve, and I think I've blogged about it, but if I haven't, you'll find it on the internet, cool curve. And it's about... It's a normal distribution graph, and he takes it to extremes. But basically it says, this is people's comfort zone. If you do things slightly outside that, he's not talking about security, but you come up with this idea, let's go and get on a spaceship to Mars this afternoon. People are like, what? If you do that in 20 years' time, they might be like, yeah, sure, okay. Or maybe they won't. Same thing's true with security. What are people's expectations, and what might they realistically do? My hack worked only because I checked to see that there was a talk at 2 o'clock. I knew the name of the person that was supposed to be speaking at 2 o'clock and what they were going to speak about. And I put a bit of thought into it. But that would be true trying to compromise just about any non-military, non-really high secure environment. Of course, you can hack those environments, and I would never suggest doing that. But just to illustrate a point, some places it's trivial to do that kind of thing. Other places it's much more difficult. But you get places which go crazy on one aspect of security and then completely forget another one. I'll give you one other story and then I'll stop, because I'm sure some of you are probably quite bored by now. I'd have been too polite not to leave. I worked for an organization for a week as a consultant. It was planned to be a week. They didn't just not like me, I don't think. Maybe they were trying me, I don't know. And on the Wednesday morning, I forgot to take my pass. I'm on a train into London. I'm quite embarrassed because it's quite a prestigious client. So I phoned my contact on the mobile, can't get through to them. Long and short it was, I said, I'll meet you in the coffee bar around the corner from the office. I'll buy the coffees, you know, I'll buy the beers or whatever, but, you know, let's get this sorted out. They didn't show. They didn't call me back. I couldn't get in touch. I was going to get grief for not doing the job because I couldn't get in, you know. So I went back to the front desk and said, what do? Big organization in the city. They sent me back to the past desk, same place I'd been on the Monday morning with my sponsor. Now, this is a very large organization. The chance of them remembering me, hopefully, aren't that great. Realistically, it's not very likely they'd remember me. They gave me a day pass. They didn't phone anybody. They didn't even check my physical identity. They didn't do anything. I just gave them this story, which was true, and they gave me a day pass. I then went back into the office in a fairly secure part of the office and said, hey, look at me. I've come in, you know, I recounted the story. And they were like, oh, yeah, that kind of happens. Yet the environment I had when I walked in the front door to get to the reception, to get to the pass desk, was I was confronted by turnstiles, physical security people. It looked like Fort Knox. Their physical security looked fantastic. Their logical security, aside from the procedural flaw, was really poor as well, because people had this perception of we're in Fort Knox. So again, wherever people tend to focus, great. If you tell me, John, what you're most interested in security, I won't bother trying to break that. I'll try some other stuff first, and then maybe come back to that. I don't hack people's environments, but doing these kind of illustrations is scary stuff. So yeah, social engineering is what worries me most. Microsoft have got access in terms of we've written the code that's running on the systems. The code's reviewed, so I don't think we'd get away with having backdoors in. But if we screw up the code, then sure, anyone running that code's vulnerable. Obviously, if you've got an insider who's trying to put backdoors in and that kind of thing.
James Bond, evil, thing.
Kind of a... that would get should get picked up by code review. It should get picked up by the internal teams trying to penetrate the systems, the external third-party teams trying to penetrate the system. I guess it's not impossible that that could happen, but we do as much as we can to mitigate that. But it's, you know, from a paranoia point of view, sure, it's a possibility. There's only so much that can happen. There's going to be some malicious individuals who work for any large organization. That's why those processes and procedures are there. But yeah, it's a good point. I'd be asking that question of any code, or any vendor. But I'm much more concerned about the high-level stuff. And the, you know, you've got an automatic update type system out there, be it ours or a third party or on a different platform altogether. How do you know those updates actually got on the machine? How do you know the user didn't have a software restriction policy that maybe killed SMS or the alternative that maybe you're using? There's all kinds of interesting areas of security that you might not cover. Sorry, I could ramble on that as well, but if you want to discuss any of these points, feel free to do that offline.